Hi everyone, I'm Mark Esper. Welcome to No Spoiler Reviews, the podcast for movie reviews with surprises left in. If you ever felt like you've already seen the film by just reading a review or had the story spoiled by its trailers, then this is the podcast for you. In this episode, you'll find all the latest movie news and No Spoiler Reviews, including Zack Snyder's restored Justice League, the latest MonsterVerse movie that is Godzilla vs. Kong, the oddball charms of Jesus Shows You the Way to the Highway, and X-Drummer, which are both available on Blu-ray. In addition to all of this, we'll be giving you a brief taste of May the 1st podcast with voiceover actress to the stars Victoria Stone, and asking if Disney is really better off on TV in our What the Genre feature. So if that's your kind of thing and you don't like knowing the ending before you start, then let's get started with a story that has dominated social media and the DC universe alike. Zack Snyder's Justice League. Is this the version to do justice to his vision? Or was current Bette Noir director Joss Whedon's remix on the money all along? Let's find out. In the distant past, a warlord called Darkseid seeks out the fabled anti-life equation, which grants power over all life. Discovering that it's been hidden on Earth, Darkseid attacks with an army of parademons and four mother boxes, all of which, when they are combined, can alter reality. Yet despite their colossal power, Darkseid is defeated by an unlikely alliance of old gods, Amazons, Antillians, humans, and a Green Lantern. With the battle now won and Darkseid's invasion dismissed, the victors decide to scatter the boxes so they can never be brought together again. However, now back in the present, the death of Superman has reawoken these mother boxes, and Darkseid's Lieutenant Steppenwolf has also heard their call. Intent on recapturing them as a prelude to Darkseid's return, can Bruce Wayne and his fragile team of superheroes stop him and save the world? Well, let's find out. Zack Snyder's Justice League is effectively far more than just a director's cut of the previously released Justice League movie. It's a full-on restoration. Having left for personal reasons, Zack Snyder was replaced by Joss Whedon, who reshot most of the movie to his own taste. As a result, the film suffered from two contrasting tones, and it unsurprisingly bombed. Left with poor box office receipts and an even angrier fan base, there were soon calls for a Snyder cut, when it was revealed that most of Snyder's version was completed prior to his leaving. So now, 3 years and 4 months later, the Snyder Cut is finally here. But was it worth waiting for? Well, despite the gap and the fact that you can only see it on HBO Max, the difference is astounding. Presented in a square aspect ratio so as to make the most of an IMAX screen's canvas, it immediately becomes apparent that every shot had been composed with this format in mind. With its swooping bird's-eye angles and its languid camera work, there's actually something very Christopher Nolan-esque about the cinematography on display. What is still constant throughout, though, is Zack Snyder's obsession with detail, which borders on the overly manicured. However, that said, this is Zack Snyder's style, and whilst his aesthetic has both its fans and its detractors, it is still a style that is uniquely his own. Moving on to the plot, the parallels to Marvel's Avengers Civil War and Endgame are unavoidable. In the Marvel movies, the Avengers are trying to stop Thanos from conquering the Earth by assembling some Infinity Stones, and here Batman and co. are trying to stop Darkseid from assembling four mother boxes, which broadly offer the same life and death powers. Life or death powers. Throw in some Lord of the Rings, one ring to rule them all symbolism, and you'll find yourself in fairly familiar territory, albeit inspired by some different influences. However, moving beyond that, and at the end of the first section, something quite unique happens. You see, Zack Snyder's Justice League starts to make sense. Yes, for the first time in all of Zack Snyder's movies, his tendency for grandiose visuals and overly furrowed brows not only feels appropriate, it also feels right. You see, this is where the email firestorm starts. Zack Snyder's Justice League isn't cinema, it's actually opera. I'll explain. Shrunk down into a four-hour runtime, this is all the Avenger movies told together as if you were like watching Wagner's Ring Cycle in one go. The movie is split up into six acts. The dialogue is oh so serious, and halfway through, unless you've got a seat next to the exit, you're going to be busting for the toilet. You see, in the end, just like opera, Zack Snyder needs 4 hours to tell a story, and therein possibly lies the key as to why his other movies like Batman vs. Superman didn't work. Had they been allowed to fully lean into this flagrantly operatic vibe as his Justice League remix does, DC could have left the equally tasty popcorn pleasing to Kevin Feige and co. As a consequence of this restoration, DC's superheroes actually get a better handling than they do in their own standalone movies. Ben Affleck makes for a more engaging Bruce Wayne, as does Gal Gadot's athletic Wonder Woman. Ezra Miller's comic relief as the Flash arrives bang on time, and Jason Momoa and Ray Fisher both vie for who has the most tortured backstory. Although I'd argue that in many ways, similar to Josh Brolin's performance as Thanos, Kieran Hines' Steppenwolf quietly steals the movie from all involved. So in the end, the appeal of Zack Snyder's 4-hour cut of Justice League really comes down to how do you like your popcorn. With Marvel uniformly electing for sweet consistency and DC plumbing for salty single takes like Todd Phillips' Joker, Zack Snyder's Justice League is without question the director's most personal vision to date. However, if the prospect of a 4-hour screening is frightening you, don't fret. Watching it over 2 evenings works out just fine, and you'll definitely enjoy the second course having been surprised by the first. Yes, because this time, Zack Snyder's movie finally delivers on the promise of its trailers. See it now on HBO Max and everywhere else probably fairly soon. So, leaving the orc-strewn trenches of a movie that was only ever really meant to be a DVD extra, let's check out now what's happening in the movie world in our latest What the Genre feature, where we ask, is Disney better off on TV? Back in 1997, Netflix's proposal of streaming movies seemed somewhere between fanciful and technologically naive. Broadband speeds were just finding their feet, and there were still video rental stores in your high street. Not anymore, though. With over 204 million paying subscribers lifting Netflix's annual revenue to $25 billion in the course of the last 25 years, yes, it really is that long, it could be argued that the streaming giants were well on their way to eventually killing off theatrical distribution. Don't believe me? Then judge the actions of Amazon, Apple, Disney, HBO, and others since. All of them now have their own streaming platforms because with those kind of profits to make, everyone was eventually going to jump into the paddling pool. However, the release of Netflix's House of Cards series is what really threw the cat amongst the pigeons. Here was a long-form television series that treated each episode like a standalone film, with stars and production values to match, and you could binge on it all the way through from day one without having to wait for sequels. Netflix didn't just round up the wagons with this, they burnt down Hollywood's assertion that there was still gold in them there cineplexes. And then came COVID, as if to underline things. However, I think the real revolution is what this has done to storytelling. Freed from the confines of a 90-minute to 2-hour feature so as to accommodate multiple cinema screenings in a day, storytelling has blossomed along with the eruption of special effects. Now with extra hours available with which to slowly bind audiences' sympathies to on-screen characters, it could really be hard to go back to conventional features. And having just recently completed phases 1 to 3 of a huge story arc culminating cinematically with Avengers Endgame, has streaming and TV arrived at the right time? Look at the most recent must-see series on streaming. The Mandalorian, WandaVision, and, still finding its feet, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. However, whilst one of those shows is from Star Wars and the other two being from Marvel, the most common DNA between them is that all these stories are about lesser-known characters, all currently fighting initially mundane battles to which wickeder things may come. So, given the potential to deep dive further into these universes on streaming platforms that are currently virus-free, why would studios wholly risk the farm on theatrical distribution coming back on stream anytime soon? More tellingly so, why would they return to the cramped runtimes of 19 and 120 minutes when they can tell deeper stories, the like of which Avengers needed over a dozen sequels to barely graze? Even DC, Marvel's rival, has started kicking at its formerly stable production format. If they can gamble on 4 hours of Zack Snyder's Justice League to bring in the subscribers, then there's definitely big changes afoot. And maybe Marvel and Disney are actually better off on TV. People can access their stories, pore over their meanings afterwards online, and wait for the next series with film production values to drop in a matter of months. So, as The Mandalorian's Din Djarin puts it, this is the way. For now. Please write in and let us know what you think, as we'd love to know your thoughts. So, now, with all that talk of TV killing cinema's movie stars, let's see just how easygoing Legendary Pictures' latest MonsterVerse offering, Godzilla vs. Kong, is going to be on your brain cells. Years after the events of Godzilla, King of the Monsters, the Titan King Kong is living a Truman Show-esque existence on Skull Island. Trapped inside a giant geodesic dome, he is monitored by Rebecca Hall's scientist Eileen and her adopted daughter Gia, who can soothe Kong's rages. However, outside the dome, others are also monitoring Kong for very different reasons. In one corner is Apex Cybernetic CEO Walter Simmons, who wants Kong to lead him to the source of the Titan's power, whereas conversely, conspiracy theory podcaster Bernie Hayes believes that Apex interests are far less benign. So when Arlene is convinced by Simmons expert Nathan Lint to strap Kong to a flotilla of ships for a voyage to Kong's homeworld, it would seem that Apex is getting everything it wants. However, in this new land of the beasts, there can only ever be one true Apex Predator, and it's about to break the waves very soon. In short, director Adam Wingard's Godzilla vs. Kong is a movie with a lot to say and never enough time or even appetite to say it, dropping you straight into the central dilemma that Kong is being hunted by Godzilla and the humans are trying to keep him safe inside a video dome. The latest addition to Legendary's Monster Universe is a movie that hits the ground with its wheels already spinning. Charging off in a dozen different directions, we meet Dame Obitia's unscrupulous industrialist Walter Simmons, Brian Tyree Henry's conspiracy theory podcast Bernie Hayes, Alex Garsgaard's heroic Dr. Lint, and Rebecca Hall's earnest scientist Eileen Andrews. However, blowing all of their scenery-holding efforts to bits is the introduction of deaf actress Kaylee Hottle. Communicating solely with sign language to all those around her, she is spared any expositional dialogue and as a result makes the film's most heartfelt impact. With a plot that borrows heavily from the Voyage of the Center of the Earth and countless video game cutscenes, there really isn't much to speak of or spoil when it comes down to Godzilla and Kong's story. It's basically all there in the title, and in this respect, the film delivers, whereas the turgid Godzilla King of the Monsters did not. Previous installment Kong Skull Island was a serviceable, if wholly unbelievable, setup, and as such, I'd say you can comfortably skip Godzilla King of the Monsters and just make the trip to Godzilla vs. Kong via Kong Skull Island. If anything, Godzilla vs. Kong is a film about adults making bad choices even worse, and as such, the featured kids make a much better fist of it. Although reduced to mainly running and shouting duties, Millie Bobby Brown and the Hunt for Wilder People's Julian Dennison easily deliver the movie's best lines, along with Kaylee Hottle, who never gets to say a word. With Junkie XL's, aka Tom Holkenborg's, drum and brass score thumping in your ears, Godzilla vs. Kong is a very dumb movie and makes zero apologies for being as such. With the inevitable Jurassic Park double cross appearing midway through, and time and distance being as meaningless concepts as hundreds of thousands of people squished in the film's many tumbling tower blocks, there really isn't much to grasp onto here. And that's the movie's real downfall. As sufficient eye candy to distract you from the pandemic outside, Godzilla vs. Kong is an okay distraction that doesn't want to be serious in any way at all. Already a pale reflection of Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim, and yes, Roland Emmerich's 1990 Godzilla reboot, both of these movies have what Godzilla vs. Kong doesn't: grandeur and scale. Sadly drifting into the distance with its paint-by-numbers inclusion of the Hollies singing The Air That I Breathe, the quest continues for adequate B-movie bash-and-smash action with some decent character development thrown in. Some might argue that Cloverfield came close, but for me, Gareth Edwards' Monsters is still the class of the field in an horizon which looks like it's about to get all the more crowded. Let's move on to some super quick reviews of other movies that are currently available at the moment in our flyby reviews. Bella Thorne is a moody adolescent with a Greyhound ticket and a grudge in director Chad First's Girl. Phoning home to a crippled mum, she swears that she's out to get justice on a father who left them for broke. However, things aren't what they seem upon arrival. The town folk are afraid, it's damp and overcast all the time, and Sheriff Mickey Rourke's 4x4 seems to be the only working car in town. That all said, whilst this revenge thriller struggles to break out of the mould, there are definitely some entertaining laybys in both Thorne's and director Chad's first on-screen performances. Altogether drier and justifiably more sombre in tone is the Australian offering The Dry, with Eric Banner as a man who should have never returned home. Long suspected as a murderous liar by the townsfolk, Banner's detective Aaron Falk is trying to steer a righteous path when his best friend is accused of killing both his family and himself. Never falling into the melodramatic trap that US thrillers often do, The Dry is a bittersweet potboiler where you know the final act revelations are going to have fatal consequences. What is a real surprise, though, is the rhythm section starring Blake Lively. Pretty much critiqued out of any consideration by my peers, I came into this knowing nothing, and there's plenty to enjoy if you look beyond the sellotape holding the plot together. Lively is a woman who has given up on life after a family is killed in an airplane accident. However, spooked Raza Jeffrey, in journalist mode, doesn't think they were. Sending her off down a vengeful path for which she's ill-equipped, the Bond-like hallmarks of producers Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli are all there to be seen. The chase is top-notch, the stunts are solid, and the cinematography is justifiably exhilarating. Yes, it's a girl with a gun with death on her mind, but this is 1,000 miles away from serial sequeler Luc Besson. Although, last up is a documentary to which no one ever needs a sequel, and in some ways is already an identikit tragedy that's still unfolding. I'm talking about Framing Britney on Amazon Prime. Destined for stardom, Britney Spears was the girl next door who brought the house down. Picking herself up after the Mickey Mouse Club closed down on TV, Britney worked her way up from shopping mall appearances to the big time. However, when the American public ever get themselves a new princess, the tabloids and their buyers love to tear them down. Now trapped in a custodianship where her low-rent dad controls every aspect of her life and her finances, Britney is a puppet on a string. Deemed well enough to earn millions of dollars performing but not leave the house unattended or have full access to her kids, Britney is caught in a web of self-interest between the courts, their lawyers, and her father. The last film to tell this kind of story was Asif Kapadia's Amy, and the parallels will set far more than just your alarm bells ringing. So, there you go. 4 film reviews, all done in double bubble quick time. Okay, so now it's time to check out one of your requested movies in our much-subscribed Request Stop feature. Now, if you're a first-time listener to the show, let me explain what this is. Request Stop is where you, the listener, can write in to us here at No Spoiler Reviews and ask us to do an in-depth, no-spoiler review on a film that you'd like to see or maybe one where you'd just like to hear our take on it. For this episode, we're going to be looking at the equally bonkers and bizarre new Blu-ray release, Jesus Shows You to the Highway. Thanks to Kieran Murdoch from Edinburgh for this request, who's tempted to splash the cash on this number but wanted us to check it out first. So let's get into it now and see if Jesus will be taking the high road to cult infamy or the fast track to obscurity. It's the 1970s, or thereabouts, and diminutive agent D.T. Gargano and Palmer Eldritch are guinea pigs in a virtual reality experiment. Charged with killing a computer virus called Stalin, Gargano is wounded by enemy agents and can no longer be brought back to life. With his plans to settle down with kickboxing wife Marlin and open a pizza joint now in pieces, can Gargano ever find his way back to reality? And more importantly, will Marlin be there waiting for him? Well, studying the beautifully rendered Blu-ray release that director Miguel Lanzo's feature has come in, I'd say there's a fair chance. This is because Jesus Shows You the Way to the Highway could never be described as a film to take itself too seriously. Knowingly stealing the best bits of films like The Matrix and the James Coburn spy thriller In Like Flint, this movie feels like a student film mashed up with a very strange never-say-die attitude when it comes to its scripting. Changing scenes in a blink of an eye, each character's regional accent slides sideways as they enter the Psycho Book, aka The Matrix. Chased by the Stalin virus, who has a very distinctive Ulster-sounding lilt to his voice, it is Daniel Tedesse's Gargano who is tasked with keeping not only the drama but the plot afloat. Shuffling between fight scenes and only pausing for breath when Gerda Annette Alikas as Marlin impressively begs him to give up the super spy life, Tedesse's acting chops are nonetheless impressive. However, the real appeal of Jesus Shows You the Way to the Highway is in its throwaway characters. Whether it's Solomon Tashi's Batfro, or the permanently hysterical Carlo Peronti as Mr. Sophistication and his ninja band of assassins, Spaghetti, Ravioli and Balthazar, the film's most rewarding elements are always to be found at the edge of the main plot. More of a movie that you introduce to your friends just so you can study their open mouths, Jesus Shows You the Way to the Highway is an unrepentantly stupid way to spend 83 minutes. Tonally similar to the similarly plotted Terence Hill and Bud Spencer movies, director Miguel Lanzo's second feature is best enjoyed with many beers, much pizza, and even lower expectations. If you're expecting anything approaching seriousness, well then this is not your film. However, taken on its own merits, I would venture that this soft-hearted descent into parody with all the professionalism of a kid's play will live long in your memory as will its catchphrases. Where some seek cult status, others have it thrust upon them. And Jesus Shows You the Way to the Highway has both. Now, as part of our ongoing film industry interviews to shine a light on those in the credits roll, I've had a chance to chat to the much-in-demand dubbing actress Victoria Sturm about how to voice a Hollywood superstar in another language. Here's a brief slice of our full-length podcast interview, which will be available to download from May the 1st. So what kind of preparation do you go through when you're setting out to re-record somebody's voice in a different language?
Actually, every morning I eat 5 pieces of ginger. No, just kidding. No, actually nothing. If it is a blockbuster, then I watch it up front. Mm-hmm. It is necessary because you work more specific, and the TV stuff is so quick. You came into the studio and the director telling you the story and the particular scene, and then let's go.
So is it like a really long process? Are there lots of laborious steps involved?
To do a dubbing thing actually, or for me as a voice actor?
Both. in terms of how long does it actually take to do a recording? And then I was going to come on to ask about your preparation.
A recording is for a movie 5 days.
Right.
And for a part of a series is it depends how many words are spoken. Actually, it is 2 days to 3-4 days.
Got it. So what's your biggest guide? What's your biggest influence? Is it the character on the page or the performance that's already been committed to the screen? Is there any kind of scope for expansion in terms of your performance?
The most important thing is the performance. You can change the words. You have a little range. You can do your own stuff. But actually, you have to come as near as possible to the original performance.
So how do you get the words to match exactly the mouth movements, particularly when you're translating a role for German audiences, where the words are typically so much longer than in English?
if you cut every, you know, then you have the time, because every sentence starts with, you know, and every sentence ends with, you know. And if you translate every, you know, you get crazy in German. Mm-hmm. Actually, for me as a voice actor, I have nothing to do with a mouth matching, because I get the script. And before, the script is done by a dubbing script writer, and his or her thing to change the words, to do it totally with a lip sync.
Okay. Okay, so you're recognized here as the go-to voice for several well-known actors. How did that come about? Is it the film stars that choose you and say, oh, I want her to be my voice for Germany?
No, because I think many of them don't know what is dubbing.
Okay.
never know that there is a person who do their voice in a foreign language. It's a thing of the German dubbing director and the person who works for a network or for Netflix, or I don't know. And they choose between 3 or 4 voices, the most matching voice to this actor.
So does it ever get strange when you're recognized for your voice when you're out and about in daily life?
No, because the people are confused, but they don't know why. For instance, if you are sitting in a cab and you say something where you want to go, and the cab driver is looking in his mirror and he see this face and he hear the voice. And for him, it's strange, because you can see it. He thinks, I know this person. No, I actually know, but kind of. But the total recognition is not there.
So it's not something you can abuse. You can phone up the tax office when you've got a complaint and say you've got it wrong.
It will be great, but no. Unfortunately, no.
Fair enough. What is the best dubbed film you've ever seen where you thought, wow, the recording was really faultless?
I don't know a particular film. The last film I saw, which was very well dubbed, is Soul, the Pixar movie. And there are a lot of films, especially the big blockbuster things, are very well dubbed.
Is there any actor or actress?
So there you have it. If you'd like to hear my full interview with Victoria and find out what it takes to be a voice actor, then download the full podcast out on May the 1st. Now, in the last of our no-spoiler reviews for this fortnight's episode, let's check out another Blu-ray release in the highly contentious Belgian comedy Ex-Drummer by director Cohen Mortier. In Flanders, 3 physically disabled musicians want a drummer for their punk rock outfit. Fueled by the notion that they only ever want to perform once at a local battle of the bands, they approach Dries, a famous writer, to join their group. Surmising that Dries' inability to play the drums can actually be his handicap, they decide to call themselves the Feminists as an affront to modern values. However, does Dries really want to be in the group, or does he have a darker, much more selfish purpose?
Director Cohen Mortier's debut feature, Ex-Drummer, is a film that starts well. Displaying more visual flourishes in the first 5 minutes than a pack of Tarantino trade-ins, you would seem to think that you're in for a real treat. However, though, almost immediately after that very first bite, the film savagely cracks your sweet tooth with jarring scenes of misogyny and sexual violence. Women are preyed upon, beaten and raped, and the whole visual grotesqueness of it all quickly knocks you sideways. So having hooked up with Dries Van Hagen's loose middle-class writer Dries, you imagine that he will be the film's conduit into some kind of deeper understanding. Instead, it quickly becomes apparent that he is the worst kind of parasite who positions himself as the solution whilst plotting the downfall of all those around him, deliberately goading and antagonizing his low-rent bandmates into more and more racism, sexism, and homophobia. The remainder of Ex-Drummer becomes a checklist as to what sensibility will be affronted next. Willfully dragging you knee-deep into more and more squalor, the movie becomes a diet of cause and effect violence, unnecessary suffering, and cruelty which teases an eventual insight. Is there a purpose? Is there a meaning to a story where every individual is a hairline trigger away from even more outrage? In short, the simple answer is no. In fact, you'll know when the game is up when, like me, you start playing bullshit bingo on a napkin as to which hot potato the filmmakers are going to roast next. As Dries Van Hagen puffs away on cigarettes that never seem to finish, and the film offers its last pretentious white flag of a credit sequence rolling backwards, you'll know that this turkey has lost all its feathers. In the end, unlike previous audience splitters like Gaspar Noé's Irreversible or Lars von Trier's more recent The House That Jack Built, Ex-Drummer is just a hedonistic full-frontal assault that isn't interested in either redemption or deeper meaning. As a film that solely thrives and glorifies in its own ambition to disgust, this is a movie that is as pretentious as its protagonist. And maybe that's the point. So desperate to shock and so keen to be talked about, and maybe I should stop right here, unless I make it seem any more nihilistically attractive. However, if there's one thing you can definitely be sure of, it's that this is one cult film the Americans won't be remaking, or at least not with the same level of sex, blood, and violence. Okay, so there you go. I think that about wraps it up for this episode. To recap, we reviewed Zack Snyder's Justice League, Godzilla vs. Kong, the surreal charmer that is Jesus Shows You the Way to the Highway, and the arguably charmless Ex-Drummer. So, if you like what you heard and you fancy having some more no-spoiler reviews delivered to your favourite listening device, then please consider subscribing. Please tell your friends, your family, and anyone else who you know who loves movies. Please hit the bell, smash the like, and share the podcast. It really does make a difference, and we do appreciate your support. That said, if there's a recent movie that you've missed or haven't heard us cover, then why not download some of our previous podcasts or drop us a line at info@nospoilerreviews.com so we can include it in an upcoming episode. Until then, please keep safe, take all reasonable precautions, and I wish you all the very best for a spoiler-free time. Looking forward to seeing you on May the 1st for my interview with voice actress Victoria Sturm, and May the 14th for our next monthly movie roundup. All the best. Bye.